Welcome to the Be Yourself Happy, Healthy, Hopeful podcast. I'm your host, Adriana Grande. I'm a health promoter at the Bulimia Anorexia Nervosa Association, also known as BANA, here in Windsor, Essex. I'm thrilled to be here with you as we begin our journey of meaningful conversations about mental health, self-acceptance, and the path to wellness. Today, I'm joined by Amy McDonald. Amy uses she/her pronouns and is a registered dietitian with a master's in science in foods and nutrition from Western University in London, Ontario. Amy lives and works in Huron County. She has spent most of her career in public health and is passionate about equitable and body-inclusive nutrition and health. We hope you walk away from this episode understanding the vital work that goes into dismantling weight stigma and advocating for systemic change. We're going to talk about how to recognize internalized weight stigma, how to find body-inclusive movement, and how we can collectively change the narrative for the next generation. We do want to make a disclaimer that we will be using the term obesity today, and we use those in quotes, but it's used in quotes to identify concerns with the term and with the focus on higher weights, as well as the medicalization and pathologization the anti-obesity rhetoric places on body size, creating both a fear of becoming fat and stigma toward larger bodies. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is very exciting conversation. Actually, Alexis, who works at BANA on the prevention team, introduced us, and she's always spoken highly of you. And then she's like, you know what? I think Amy would be a great podcast guest. And here we are.
Thank you again for having me. I had the pleasure of getting to know Alexis a little bit, as well as some of your other colleagues through the Eating Disorder Ontario prevention work. And I really enjoyed working with them.
Amazing. All right. So to get started, I ask everyone this opening question, but can you share a bit about what drew you to working in public health and dietetics? Was there a personal moment or experience that lit this path for you?
So when I went away to university, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to be. I thought I wanted to be a teacher, and I was trying to decide what do I do my undergrad in? And I knew I was really interested in health and in science. And so I considered kinesiology, food and nutrition, just a plain old general bachelor of science degree. And I landed in nutrition. And I loved it. I really, really enjoyed it. And so I didn't apply to teachers college. Instead, I went through to become a registered dietitian. And I had had a number of experiences during my undergrad and during my master's, and actually the year between my undergrad and my master's, to get some experience in public health. And I really loved the focus on understanding systems and structures and the reasons why, you know, we make the choices that we make and how those are influenced by things like the social determinants of health. And so public health was where I was hoping to land. And I was really lucky to spend the first 17 years of my career in public health.
That's amazing. And obviously, you know, doing research for our conversation, your work there was incredibly impactful, locally, provincially, across Canada, and the things that you contributed to inform, you know, whether it be school nutrition or those social determinants of health, all amazing work.
You know, I can't take credit for all of it, but working with other public health dietitians from across the country, we've accomplished a lot. And it was really great to have the opportunity to support community partners and staff locally around like infant and child feeding, as well as weight stigma and how we talk about weight and lots of other things along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And weight stigma is what I'm really looking forward to digging into today and unpacking a little bit, because I don't think many people, maybe people understand the concept of weight stigma, but to hear that term may not know what it is. So we will dive into it. But I do want to talk about, I learned that your very first job in public health involved developing an obesity strategy. Yes. So can you want to talk a little bit more about that?
I started as a brand new grad in public health, and one of the first things I was asked to do was to develop a quote unquote obesity strategy. I knew that public health was big and that I had a lot to learn. And so I spent a fair bit of that first year kind of getting the hang of things and to understanding the research around weight science, obesity prevention, obesity treatment, and connecting with my colleagues to understand what others were doing in public health in that area. At the time, it was our directive to support healthy weights. And so, what I learned was that our body weight shape and size is a lot more complex than what we are kind of led to believe when you use the terms healthy weights or when you talk about things like body mass index. And, I landed on, I think our approach should be not to focus on weight at all. And it was a multi-year process. I had lots of conversations with colleagues provincially, colleagues internally, and it took us probably 4 years to come up with our kind of own internal policy and process about how we were going to talk about weight. Not that we hadn't been changing things a little bit at a time. And then, within a few years after that, we were changing a lot of things provincially as well. So I feel like I should have more to say there, but.
No, that's great. That I think it kind of walks us through how your perspective shifted, because when I learned that, it's so interesting because as the general public, I'll include myself in that group, we look to, health units or public health for that gold standard of how we should do things or approach things. And I really appreciated hearing that shift. And also, I didn't know that it took that many years for that approach to shift, which does make sense knowing what I know now. But moving from that weight normative model to like that, to realizing that weight stigma like is the issue, or one of the issues, I guess.
Yeah, and so it's neat to think about the history of it a little bit. When I started, I was able to find lot there was lots of old paper files that I got to go through, and there was lots of stuff public health was doing about body image and feeling good about the body that you're in the 90s and early 2000s. But the policy environment changed in the, maybe 2007, 2009-ish. And certainly the way that I was trained as a dietitian was really weight normative, focused on weight. I certainly had questions about BMI because I things that I learned didn't always fit with things that I experienced, but I was taught that that was something that we focused on and it took some unlearning for me and definitely some unlearning for my colleagues. And I would say that like it's an ongoing process. And there are lots of people around the globe who are trying to do this work in their own individual organizations, regions, countries. And I think it's really important work, but we're not all at the same place yet. And research about weight stigma is something that it was brand new in the, like, I think about 1960s. There was lots of fat liberation work that started then, and it's kind of ebbed and flowed over the last decades. But since probably about 2018, there's been a lot more scientific research published showing weight stigma and really stigma, all forms of stigma. Have a really negative impact on health. I don't think there's complete agreement on the one way to address weight stigma. But I certainly feel that the most effective way is to be more inclusive and to change the way that we've focused on weight, because we've done a lot of things that we know have been harmful over the years.
Absolutely. Yes. I think acknowledging that too is just part of that repair process for folks who have been harmed by that. So yeah, we're all learning, we're all unlearning, and it is a process. So I'm glad we said that out loud because it is true. It's so true. So in your advocacy work, including, your recent contributions for weight inclusive approaches in school nutrition education, you do talk about a weight bias and stigma, even discrimination, how they're all distinct. How do you define weight stigma specifically?
I'm going to take a moment and look up
Yeah.
the version that I often use.
Absolutely.
And I think, to be honest, I think that it shifts a little bit depending on what setting that you're using the words in. But one way I like to talk about stigma is it's really about the labeling of difference and the social disapproval or worth that's associated with that difference. And the way that individuals and systems and structures treat people with that characteristic differently. And so, it starts with having biases. We have those like negative beliefs, attitudes, stereotypes that we have often been taught really in a kind of in a quiet way where we don't necessarily realize that we're learning those things, whether it's from, even children's programming, definitely from media, news media, social media, and of course, adult based media and programming, like beauty ideals and beliefs about health. We're taught all of these little things about weight, and when we're not taught to question those, then oftentimes they lead to really strong beliefs that may lead to us treating somebody poorly because of their weight. And we know that people can be discriminated against based on their weight, where they don't get fair treatment because of their body shape and size. And so those are the things that we're trying to address in our advocacy efforts. And it is important when it comes to working with kids and working with schools and in the school system. It's also important in workplaces and public
Absolutely.
settings and in healthcare, because if we have systems that are planned for only a certain standard body shape and size, then they're automatically excluding the people who don't fit in those shapes and sizes. So.
Yes, thank you for explaining it like that. I think your explanation also showed like the breadth of like ways it can impact people. And I think something that really stood out for me when we were preparing for the podcast was that I feel like we can understand that weight stigma affects the individual, right? But then what I really liked about you said, it not only does it affect the individual and how they feel about themselves, but then it impacts the way they show up in the world, how they interact in the world. So I thought that was just like a dynamic I hadn't really thought of in that way before. I knew it happened, but when I read it, I was like, yes, it doesn't, it's not just like how I feel in my body. It's then how I show up or someone, in their body and how someone shows up in the world and how would that change if there wasn't that weight stigma.
Yeah, it's complicated because it's about how someone feels about themselves and maybe doesn't feel that they deserve to be treated any better or any differently. It's about believing the things that have been said to them because it's just common. It's just the way that it is. And so when we talk about stigma, we often talk about it in like at a few different levels that it can happen. So it can happen at the personal level where you get maybe individuals, they could be family, they could be parents, they could be friends, they could be family doctors, they could be anyone you run into making comments that make you feel uncomfortable or that are targeted about your body shape and size. They could be you being worried about other people making comments about your body shape or size. And then it can also be in the way that interactions happen and the way that you're treated kind of by like larger groups of people and services, as well as at like an institutional level where the space isn't set up. So you show up at, it could be a clinic, it could be at a public event, it could be at something that you've paid money to go to, and you're the seats are too small for you to sit
Mm-hmm.
in them comfortably, and you either can't get into them or you can get into them, but it hurts and maybe physically causes bruises and sores, where you have to ask to be accommodated to find a seat that fits you. And it can be much more than that. Like, we see people who are told they can't have access to certain healthcare because they can't fit in the machine. It gets to be really complicated in terms of how it influences people. And then, less severe but still impactful things like going to an amusement park and not being
Right.
able to fit on a ride, or being worried about sitting on a chair at a barbecue and whether it's going to hold you safely, or worried that you might fall down because it's not a high enough weight capacity. There's so many different things that it affects. And if you've lived all of your life, like I have, I've lived my life in a fairly average size body. And so I haven't personally experienced weight stigma in any, I've had people make comments about my BMI and maybe you could lose a few pounds, but I've never had to worry about not fitting into a space. And it has a huge impact, especially if you have that in those internalized negative feelings about yourself as well. If you feel fairly confident in your own body, you may still experience really major challenges in accessing spaces that aren't made to for bodies like yours, but you might be able to tolerate it better than if you feel really negatively and that you're really hard on yourself about it.
Yes, that was excellent. You also answered my next question of just, which is perfect. I love when that happens. But I was going to ask about those everyday examples
Oh, there's so
of
many.
how it shows up. Do you have any others that come to mind?
I think about things like news media, and it ebbs and flows, but we often see, studies published or articles written that talk about if you just do this, you can be this size, or you can change your health in this way. That, Heart and Stroke Foundation saying 80% of these chronic diseases are preventable. It's a lot more complicated than that. We know that there's a lot of systems that have an influence on our health. And yes, we can make lots of positive choices that are going to influence our health in a positive way, but it's not only about weight, and it's not only about the choices that we make. It's also about the experiences we have in the world, what sort of stigma and discrimination we experience, and what sort of access to resources that we have. Those all have a big play a big factor in our health outcomes. I think, we see articles that say just that they're successful. They say that we've shown how successful people can be at losing X amount of weight, but you read the fine print and you realize that successful might be 7 pounds. And that's not going to make you go from having a higher BMI and having difficulty fitting into spaces to having, a quote unquote normal or healthy BMI and being able to buy clothes at any store and be able to always fit into public spaces. So I think there's been challenges in the way that we've communicated information and the way that we've learned information that make it unusual for people not to have some biased beliefs about weight. And I think that's really important because, though, going to the doctor and having your weight checked shouldn't be a really challenging experience because of all of the negative associations with it, it can be.
Absolutely.
And so recognizing how, while being asked for your weight might not be harmful to you and your mental health, that it could be to somebody else, I think is really important. And same with having conversations about weight and weight loss or weight gain, recognizing that different people are going to experience those conversations really differently.
Absolutely. I think even, how people are treated, talking about the doctor's office, but how people are treated based on their body weight, shape, and size. Yeah, that stigma in healthcare. I bring this up not to shame like healthcare professionals, but I do think it's helpful to acknowledge it because I'm hoping it can just validate someone's experience who may be listening of, you know what, that has happened to me and that did not feel good. And knowing that was weight stigma at play and not any personal failure is important. I mean, I've heard, you know, examples of, you know, someone going in with their ankles been bothering them. And then their primary care provider being like, well, if you just lost weight, right? And then, but someone in a nor quote unquote normal BMI, they're going to be treated differently. I don't know. Do you have thoughts on that?
There's a fairly popular meme
Okay.
that of a person that comes in with their arm severed. It's a cartoon.
Yeah.
And the doctor says, "Well, have you tried losing weight?" And sometimes it feels like that. You go in for an ear infection, you go in for a fever, you go in for an injury, and you get very different treatment depending on your body shape and size. And sometimes it's, you know, we're all busy. I work in healthcare. I recognize that, like, oftentimes colleagues don't intend to cause harm, but sometimes we do, and we need to reflect on that. I also was thinking about your question earlier. In addition to weight specifically, things like nutrition, we've come to believe that the way that we eat is really, really important, which, you know, it can be, but oftentimes, what we think of as healthy is often what we think of often means lower calories or less fat or whatever nutrient of the day we are trying
Right.
to prior focus on
Protein.
or any particular group of people may be focusing on. And so we start to have these internalized beliefs that like it can't be healthy if it's high in calories. Sometimes the healthiest choice might be high in calories for you, or it might be it's not necessarily the lowest calorie option. So I think it's just really important to reflect that kind of the beliefs that we've come to have about things that might impact our weight, whether it's exercise, whether it's eating, whether it's other healthcare factors, that we often have these underlying beliefs about them, and it can make it really challenging for us to have effective conversations about those things without people feeling judged. So I can think of an example of myself in my 20s, which is still a fairly long time ago now, where I had a lot of pain happening and my blood pressure was really high. And my nurse practitioner said, "You know, how much are you exercising?" I was playing sports on the weekend, but I was working or doing schoolwork and not exercising at all during the week. But my assumption was that she meant you need to exercise to lose weight. What she really meant was that I need to exercise on a regular basis because it's good for my blood pressure, regardless of any impact on my weight. So I wasn't being told I needed to lose weight, but I still took that information that was provided to me, that was good advice, and w didn't know what to do with it because I was worried or because I misinterpreted what she meant. And it turns out exercising regularly was really good for me. It didn't affect my weight, but it did affect how I felt mentally, physically, and my blood pressure then normalized for a period of time till I got into my 40s. But I think we just have to think about how the things that we say may be interpreted differently than what we mean. And that happens in healthcare, but it also happens in schools. And that's where that article that we wrote in the Canadian Journal of Dietetic Practice and Research comes in. Oftentimes, when we're trying to teach children about healthy eating, we might be inadvertently teaching them about dieting. And so the intention in that article was to ask educators and people who support educators to, you know, question the way that we talk about food and healthy eating for kids. And I'm also really grateful to have Ontario Dietitians and Public Health has some really good resources for educators too, that are along those lines. And there are many other resources available, you know, across Canada that are aligned with that kind of messaging too.
Yes, and I'm going to share, I'll share a link to the article that we've been referencing in the show notes, but the title is School Nutrition Education in Canada: Call to Action for Dietitians to Advocate for Social Justice, which is, I mean, since working at BANA, I've, learned so much. I've been unpacking a ton of things, but a lot of the clinicians here really doing a lot of like learning around the social justice piece of all of this. So it was, I loved reading this article that you and your colleagues wrote. Because a lot of, at BANA, my role and Marissa, my colleague, we do presentations in schools. And so there are a lot of very well-meaning educators, but just you have your own personal beliefs, and then you want what's best for these kiddos, and some of the things can get a bit jumbled. And actually, my last guest on the podcast was Karen Belmore, who I know does a lot of great work locally. And so to know that, you're doing this, broader work, and Karen's here in our community doing it locally, it's just so refreshing to see, because it, like the article says, it's a lot of the curriculum that was shared is a lot of like personal responsibility, where like how much personal responsibility can like a JK to grade two, I would say in grade school period, how can they have that
Absolutely.
responsibility? Some days I don't know how I have this responsibility to make these decisions. And so, yeah, I really appreciated the suggesting that shift, right, to how else can we approach this?
So I have several things I'd love to say.
Yeah, let's hear it.
So, I guess I should start with, in public health, we talk about the social determinants of health. And those are things like education and income and w the environment that we live in and our working conditions and the supports that we have. And when we're talking about social justice, we mean the fair distribution of those things across society. Because what we know happens is that people who have the least resources, the least income, they are much more likely to have poorer health outcomes. And it's not because of them not having knowledge and information. It's because of less access to resources. And so we want to take that lens when we're talking about presenting to a group of school kids. Some families are going to have, maybe they have to access food from the food bank. Maybe they are working three jobs and all they can manage to pull together is packaged foods. There's lots of different reasons that people are making the choices that they're making. And I think like the practice of actually kind of brainstorming all of those different reasons can sometimes be really helpful. And so one, we're talking about the resources that family have to what food they send with kids to school. The first thing I'd like to see us do, if we're noticing kids don't have enough food or don't have maybe nutritionally balanced meals, offer them access to the student nutrition program. That's something schools can do. If schools have that program, they can offer that to them. At lunchtime, there's no, we don't want to be judging and shaming what different kids are packing and what different families have. And even if we think we're being helpful in that information sharing, sometimes what happens is the kids pick up on that judgment and then they start doing it to each other. So it's really important as adults that we're demonstrating, no, it's not okay to make a comment about somebody else's food being yucky or not meeting whatever standards that you set. There's actually some really cool articles that have come out recently about lunch shaming, especially cultural foods. Food can be a way to talk about diversity, that different people eat different things. That's what they grew up eating at home, and that's what they like, and that's perfectly okay. And you don't have to eat what they're eating, and they don't have to eat what you're eating. Actually, we're encouraging you not to share. That's important. And then when it comes to teaching about healthy eating at school, if you're talking with young kids in early elementary school, I don't personally think, like, I'm a dietitian. I know nutrition matters, but I don't think we should be talking to kids specifically about nutrition. I think we should be teaching kids about food in a neutral way. You can absolutely choose to focus on foods that, are in Canada's food guide and teach them about those foods. Great. That's a way of teaching nutrition without teaching nutrition. You're focusing on foods that offer lots of nutrients. And they're learning about food. They're learning about their five different senses. They're learning about how things grow. They're learning like science, social sciences. There's lots of opportunities for kids to learn about food that aren't categorizing things as good or bad or healthy or unhealthy. As kids get older, they can start to have those conversations because they can start to better understand the nuance that, any one food in alone, I don't think can be healthy or unhealthy. Like, I will sometimes give the example of if I offered you a plate of broccoli and a plate of pizza, what would be the more nutritious lunch? And you're going to get various responses from people, but that plate of broccoli is probably not going to be very filling for very long. It's not offering a whole lot of protein or fat, and it not balanced. That plate of pizza might be a more nutritionally balanced option that's going to get kids through the school day than the plate of broccoli. Even but if you're talking about nutrition density, like broccoli is a great choice. Pizza with broccoli, great choice. Like we need to be able to have some nuance about it. And because young kids are such concrete thinkers, it's hard for them to understand that nuance. So let them learn about food in a non-judgmental way. And as they get older, we can start having bigger, broader conversations about food and understanding nutrients and where what nutrients do for our body and why having a mix of them is a good thing.
Absolutely. I just love that you bring up nuance. I love talking about nuance. I feel like we just live in a world of black and white,
Yeah,
but
it's easy to.
it's just there's so much nuance to everything. And I just feel like if we could sometimes embrace that, we would have more compassion for ourselves and others in the decisions that people make. Which I've learned, between, dietitians at BANA, care in yourself, just like nutrition is one of the most nuanced things. But what we're sold is, well, if you eat this, then you get this outcome, and everyone can do this or should do this, and
We know
nuance.
is that healthy eating really does look different for everyone. If you have a food allergy or you have an intolerance or you have a chronic illness or you're a picky eater that's still learning how to eat a variety of foods, what meets your needs at this time is going to look different from somebody else. And even I think about myself, some of my friends joke about, well, Amy has to eat 5 times a day. And maybe that's not quite as true as it was in the past, but for some of us, we do best when we have small, frequent meals. For others, 3 square meals a day is great. We all have slightly different needs, and when we listen to our bodies, we're able to meet those needs a lot better. And if we're teaching external rules, we're teaching people to ignore those internal signals that tell us what we need. And sometimes people need help to understand those internal signals, but healthy eating is going to look a little bit different from one person to the next. And it doesn't need to be a rule following way. I really like Ellen Satter describes, normal eating as like flexible. You can adjust it depending on your context and your situation. Sometimes you're eating ahead of when you're hungry because you know if you don't eat now, you're going to be starving later and you're not going to have time to eat later. Like that we kind of make up for those challenges in eating by understanding how it makes us feel. And it's not about eating the exact same thing or in the exact same way. And it's not about always saying no to dessert or cookies or chips. It's about having some flexibility and some compassion is kind of the vibe that I'm
Yeah.
going for, like being okay with being okay. Like we don't,
Yeah.
there's no perfect. That it doesn't need to be perfect. It just needs to be, you know, we're trying to get enough and we're trying to make do and do our best. And I think that's really important. And it's really important for kids too. And if we try to put too many rules in place, sometimes we end up, it backfires. The kids that we're trying to get to eat more are like, no way, I don't want to touch it. And then you can't get them to eat. We know that happens with kids who we are restricting. All of a sudden, they can't get enough and they don't want to stop. So we need to kind of support those natural eating skills and then refer out to
Yeah.
healthcare providers if we need more support. It's I also think the other thing to consider, and I know Karen talked about this on your last podcast, is food insecurity. You know, food insecurity can have a huge impact on kids in school. We know that like one in four families experiences household food insecurity. That's huge. Yes, parents and caregivers do everything they can to try and insulate their kids from being hungry, but you know, they experience, some of them are going to experience it too, and we don't want kids to feel bad because they can't afford to have all the fresh fruits and vegetables and
Yeah.
that's not an option. And so I think we have to keep that in mind too.
Absolutely. Everything you just said, I think, also applies across the lifespan
I agree.
that we, as a parent to two young kids, you know, like we want to teach these intuitive eating behaviors and this flexibility around food. And then, you know, knowing like myself or other people in my life who, you know, are also learning for the first time or maybe the 10th time, you know, how to approach food with flexibility and have that nuance. And then you have people later in life who are like, why did I restrict food my whole life? I
And
was missing out on so much joy. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I agree completely. And we have people later in life who are still restricting and still
Yeah.
struggling. And I don't want to see our kids growing up struggling. I want us to find ways to support everyone across the lifespan to be able to meet their needs without a lot of struggles about food. And I think that starts with us valuing all body shapes and sizes, all abilities, all physical appearances, all different ways of eating. And, you know, we have to have some, you know, to help people understand that we're going to eat differently. We can learn lots of different cool things about nutrition, but that we need to look at kind of the bigger picture, that it's much broader than just how many nutrients are in this food or how many calories are in this food. And to understand that there are more than one way to eat in a balanced way and support your health. And if it's complicated, then we, you know, we get extra support.
Yes, I 100% agree. And
I'm
just
not sure I
go.
captured that as well as I wanted to, but like it's
No, that was excellent. Excellent. I have a couple of things highlighted in this article, but with all of this in mind, going back, it says here that, you know, it talks about school nutrition education, but I think any type of anti quote obesity messaging will perpetuate that weight stigma, which could then, whether that's explicitly or implicitly, may contribute to psychological distress, social isolation, shame, disordered eating, reduced physical activity, and worsened health outcomes.
Yeah, we have
So,
research that says that.
yes, I can, all the references are linked, obviously, at the end of the article, but just how that continuum works of from that education and that messaging to the weight stigma, and then how it affects every single aspect of a person's life, which is really what I want. After you and I talked for the first time, what I wanted the main takeaway from this episode to really be is that it affects weight stigmas. I want to clarify, affects everything. It can, you know, be ev someone can experience it in so many places, how they feel about their. I just want, yes, I just wanted to say that out loud, that it is just affects so many aspects of a person's life, which is why I want to like name it and explain it so that people can understand how it's showing up in their life. Do you have thoughts?
I think that's so important. I've given so many presentations on weight stigma, whether it's related to nutrition or physical activity or just weight stigma in general. And yeah, it's everywhere. I've heard so many different examples of it's like we're swimming in a stew of it. You bump in here and there and everywhere. Like we have so many, there's so many potential exposures to weight bias and weight stigma. And the people who experience it the most are usually people in larger bodies, although anyone can experience weight stigma. And, you know, there's been research that shows like regardless of what someone's actual body size is, the more they've experienced weight stigma or experienced perceived weight stigma, the more it has an impact on them. So we know it's not helpful. We know it's harmful. We know it starts at such a young age. We see like kids as young as three preferring thinner bodies. We see students in high school that are like more than half of students that responded to the Ontario Student Drug Use and Health Survey saying that they'd been bullied about their weight or their body size in the last year. Like, I think it's something like 57% of students had been trying to control their weight. And it's not 57% of students that are all at a higher weight. Like, and even if it was, I still have concerns about students who are growing, trying to control their weight. You know, the media exerts so much pressure for kids, for teens, for adults. And if we can teach critical thinking skills, we can teach nuance, and we can talk about diversity in what we eat and what our bodies look like, I think we would make such a huge difference for everyone in their health and well-being in the long run.
Yes, I agree. And another question that I had was around that weight-based bullying. And my question was, how can parents advocate for their kids, or how do they what tools can they give them, whether that be in school or in a sport setting where people may still be pushing those weight normative ideas?
So I've done a lot of presentations in school settings, not many of them recently, but I was amazed at how well students received it when I explained, like, bodies come in all shapes and sizes, and there's nothing wrong with that. That is normal. That's the way we've always been, and that's the way we always will be. And that trying to control our body weight, shape, and size often is more challenging in the long run, causes more harm in the long run. And that people come in lots of body shapes and sizes that are able to do everything that they want and need to do with their life. And so we need to be careful that we're not inadvertently teaching kids that you're in a bigger body, so you can't participate in this sport, or you can't participate in this activity, or you can't wear these fashionable clothes, or you can't enjoy same social activities. We need to make sure that we're not inadvertently telling kids that there's something wrong with their body and that they can't do those things. We also need to recognize, like, be that safe space where kids can come to us and have those conversations. And they can say, I feel uncomfortable. Or they can say that I'm struggling because every child, every teen, their body grows differently. They may start gaining weight before they get taller. They may grow earlier than their peers or later than their peers. They're very often going to turn out to have a very similar body type to one of their parents, at least. And so helping them by showing them that, you know, like, this is what my body looks like, and my body can do all of these amazing things, and I'm comfortable in my body. Even if you're struggling a little bit, don't make your children worried about looking like you in the future, right? Make them know that it's okay if they turn out to look like you in the future, that your tummy or your thighs or those things that make you self-conscious, that there's nothing wrong with them, I think is really important. And you can also help by showing kids other examples, by having books, stories, social media that show body diversity, that show that, you know, a lot of books will show stereotypes about the heavier kid only eats this way and the skinnier kid only eats this way, but we know in real life that that's not reality. So being able to show our kids those examples, I think, is so powerful. And I'm sure there's a lot, I know that there are lots of other great resources out there, mental health professionals, dietitians, others who have lots of other great examples.
Absolutely. One that I'm always comes, I feel like I'm on this website daily, but Bright Bites. Marissa and I reference all the time and refer educators
That
to
one's
it.
perfect
They
for schools in Ontario specifically. Yeah.
yes but I've been going through all of their recommended resources, and they do offer books, or I'm trying to think what else, like videos that you can use as tools that you mentioned, whether that be food, the exposure to different cultures and how they cook food and how they enjoy food, or bodies. I'll link that in the episode description too, as a great, I think even as a parent, knowing like what is a realistic expectation of what my kid should know about nutrition, and leaving it at that is really helpful and can probably take the pressure off a lot of folks
I
too.
think so. I think sometimes we want to teach everything, but what we really, I think we really need to teach is how to access the information when we need it. So we don't necessarily have to know everything there is to know about nutrition. We need to get kids to the point when they're done high school that they know how they can find out what they need when they need it, and to support them along the way. And you know, there are also great, like, there's great resources that are targeted those younger age groups, like Bright Bites. There's some good stuff for coaches of older kids, especially we have a lot of resources for girls because we know a lot of girls stop playing sports because they feel self-conscious. Also for people who are 2S LGBTQ plus, for people with disabilities, for anyone who experiences any types of discrimination, or feels that like they don't fit in, like there are resources out there to help us do a better job at moving towards inclusion and helping kids feel like they belong in the spaces where they're going to school, where they're participating in sports and whatnot. And again, I can probably provide you with a lengthy list of resources if you'd like.
I would obviously love that. Thank you. I will take you up on that. Something that we haven't talked about yet, but we kind of chatted about it, but when the society as a whole is just constantly bombarding us with weight bias and weight stigma, we internalize it. And what does internalized weight stigma look like in someone's daily life, or how might it fuel disordered eating or avoidance of maybe a health space?
That's a good question. We do see that people who experience weight bias and weight stigma are more likely to avoid going to the place where they've experienced that. So it could be the gym, it could be the grocery store, it could be the bus, it could be a healthcare provider's office. We often see stats that say, you know, having a BMI of this is associated with higher risks of this. Yes, but it's also associated with less likely to get screening and more likely to be declined certain screening because, oh, you should just try to lose weight first. So, those sorts of experiences can make people avoid participating in healthcare and self-care. We know that there's research that shows that people who've experienced stigma are more likely to have more difficulty eating, you know, well-balanced, meeting their nutritional needs. They're more likely to have more difficulty participating in exercise. I mean, What if you can't find equipment that fits or
Right.
like clothes that work? People stop playing sports because they can't find equipment that fits their bodies. People might feel uncomfortable going to the gym because either the equipment there isn't comfortable or they feel like they're being judged for being there. There's lots of different things that, can make it really difficult. And then people internal some when somebody internalizes those things, they feel like I'm not valuable, I'm not worthy, I don't deserve better treatment, and aren't comfortable advocating for better treatment. So if somebody doesn't have internalized weight stigma, weight bias, they're much more likely to be able to say, that's not okay.
Right.
Actually, I still want this test, or actually, I'm still going to go to the gym. I'm going to ask for something that I need. So internalized, it can be really harmful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I just realizing that it we've internalized it, or someone has, is a breakthrough step in moving towards. I'm sure for a lot of folks, they probably need support, whether that be a mental health professional or someone like that, to walk them through their experience and validating it and how to make that shift.
And I think the same is true for healthcare providers, for educators, for fitness professionals. The first step, that first breakthrough, is acknowledging and recognizing if you do have some internalized, like some weight bias beliefs, if we want to make changes in not stigmatizing other people. And it often is a process because sometimes we will have the best intentions and still say or do something that we didn't realize was hurtful. And I think, sometimes we have to work through those too. It's on both sides. I know I'm always learning. I'm always learning things, and I don't always say the perfect thing or the right thing at all times. Sometimes the best thing you can do is say, "I'm sorry, you're right. I was wrong." And do your best to remedy the situation in the most appropriate way possible.
Absolutely. Yeah, that admit it and accept it and learn and apologize and
And
move
then move
forward.
on. Yeah, move forward. Yeah.
I'm thinking if someone listening today, is like, oh, I think I have internalized some of this, or maybe they can think of a friend or a family member that may be experiencing this, how could they, or what's one small shift they can make in their language or daily habits to either support themselves or someone they care about?
That's a good question. And I think the answer could be lots of different things. It could be that, and for supporting someone else, it's that, we're not trying to help. Like, sometimes we try to help by offering suggestions when what we really need to do is listen. And sometimes we have conversations about weight and our concerns about our own weight or our concerns about somebody else's weight far more frequently than we need to. Like, those are certainly conversations you can have with your own healthcare provider, but sometimes trying to stop how much we're focusing on weight and talking about weight can be really helpful to everyone around you, including yourself. I'm sure there's another great suggestion
No, I think that's
that,
great.
but I think, there's no one perfect answer. So I think it's we just take sometimes it's baby steps and we can make a big difference. I think the students that we work with, the families that we work with, all of the different settings that we work in. Sometimes it's just we acknowledge what we've learned and we try to do better.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. Anything else before I get into our standard wrap-up questions that we haven't discussed, or, something that you want to make sure that we talk about?
I honestly think the only thing I can think about for sure off the top of my head is I have some resources that I want to share. Hopefully, this is a start of more of these conversations. I know you've got
Absolutely.
lots of other awesome guests who are like-minded, and hopefully, This is an opportunity to continue to share that message.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm very I mean, I'm biased. However, everyone who's been on the podcast, I'm extremely grateful to because they've all had their own nuggets of wisdom, whether it be general mental health or specific to eating disorders or, how we move our bodies, right? Everyone has left their mark for our listeners, and I'm very grateful for that. Okay, you ready for our final round
Yes.
of questions? Okay. Is there a story or a specific instance when working in the weight stigma space has helped someone in particular that stood out for you?
For me, I think the thing that has been most helpful is engaging with other professionals in the space and learning from others' experiences. I could not have gotten so confident and comfortable talking about this topic if I wasn't learning from others. And I also feel like the more we talk about it, with our colleagues, the more we can all move forward and enhance all of our knowledge and understanding. And so I think the biggest thing for me was being persistent in exposing myself to other people's experiences and messages and sharing what I learned. And I have been grateful to see colleagues who have went, that message there, that's stigmatizing. Or that doesn't seem accurate. Like that doesn't make sense. Let's go look it up. And, like one example was a colleague had seen something that said that people of a certain body size are more likely to be in car accidents. And she went, what? That doesn't make sense. But it was more likely to be injured because the car seats were not made to meet different body sizes. And so having ongoing conversations and engagement on the topic has been so helpful. And it's been so great to see that, you're not the only one doing it. There's lots of other people doing this work too, and we're all kind of eating away at it as we can.
Absolutely. Yeah, it does, decades of people building a movement around this, that everyone has their part in it.
Yeah, no one person, one paper, one researcher, one program is going to solve it. It's going to take lots of people making small changes. And, sometimes somebody will make a big change and that will be fantastic. But
Yeah.
lots of people continually making small changes is going to make a difference.
Absolutely. And if our listeners could only take away three simple facts about weight stigma, what would they be?
Stigma in any shape or form is harmful. Adjusting our thoughts and ideas about things so that we are being more inclusive and not being exclusive in any way is so important, if we want to support people's health and well-being. And there are lots of great resources out there. Anyone in healthcare, Ontario Dietitians and Public Health has a really great position statement and lots of great resources. There are lots of other primary care resources out there as well. And Bright Bites is also by Ontario Dietitians and Public Health for educators. And there are, there's body confidence sport and there's other inclusive physical activity and fitness resources. There are lots of tools and resources out there in Ontario, in Canada, and globally. There are lots of resources, if you go looking.
And we will add everything that you can offer us into the episode
You don't
description.
want me to send everything because the list
Okay.
is too long.
I'll take your best ones.
Yeah.
All right. And if, I was thinking about this earlier, but if you could go back to the version of yourself working on that first public health quote unquote obesity strategy,
Which I never
what?
finished.
Okay. Well,
I
there
know.
you go. But knowing everything that you know now about weight stigma and social justice, what is the first thing you would tell her besides stop?
That you are going to continue to learn and change your opinion and change your perspective. And this is going to be really important work for you and your career. And that keep going, keep learning, keep changing, and keep trying to make a difference.
I love it. Beautiful. Where can our listeners find more information about the work that you do?
I am on LinkedIn. I am on Instagram. I'm not doing a ton in that area. I have a 9 to 5 or 8 to 4 job that keeps me busy, so I'm not able to do as much as I'd like. Ontario Dietitians and Public Health is a great place to start. So your local public health unit. I'm not that hard to find if you are looking for me and want to get in touch. I want to continue to do as much of this work as I can, but there are also lots of other great folks out there doing this work too. So it definitely doesn't have to be just me. Make change happen. There's lots of dietitians that are doing this school nutrition education stuff that are aligned in their thinking. And organizations like BANA and NEDIC, and I'm sure there's others.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you so much, Amy, for taking the time today to join me outside of your busy schedule. I know so many folks listening will find this conversation not only helpful, but probably validating, a little bit eye-opening, and will hopefully have a bit more compassion for for themselves and how they show up in the world and do all the things they want and can accomplish. So thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
And for our listeners, if you're interested in learning more about eating disorders in Windsor, Essex, please find us on your socials at BANA Windsor, our website, bana.ca, or read more in the BANA Be Yourself magazine. Thank you for joining us and see you next time.